VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Rick Pantaleo.
This is the science edition of VOA's Press Conference USA. Hi, I'm your host, Rick Pantaleo. Welcome to our 50th anniversary celebration of the Apollo 11 moon landing, one of the greatest accomplishments in human history.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
The Apollo 11 mission began its trip to the moon on July 16, 1969, at 1332 hours UTC, when the spacecraft, sitting atop the massive Saturn V rocket, took off from the Kennedy Space Center's Launch Complex 39A.
12, 11, 10, 9, ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
It was July 21st, 1969, at 2 hours 56 minutes and 15 seconds Universal Time, or 10:56 p.m. on July 20th, 1969, in Washington, D.C., when Commander Neil Armstrong stepped off from the lunar module named Eagle and became the first human ever to set foot on the moon. Commander Armstrong made his way into the history books with these words.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Armstrong was soon joined on the moon's surface by the lunar module's pilot, Buzz Aldrin. Armstrong and Aldrin spent the next 2.5 hours on the moon taking photos and videos, deploying science experiments and mementos, and collecting samples of moon rocks and soil. But the path that led humans to the moon actually began a little over 9 years earlier. It was May 25, 1961, just 20 days after NASA sent the first American, Alan Shepard, into space, when the late President John F. Kennedy addressed a special joint session of Congress to issue an unforgettable challenge.
I therefore ask the Congress, above and beyond the increases I have earlier requested for space activities, to provide the funds which are needed to meet the following national goals. First, I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish.
Today on the Science Edition of Press Conference USA, we will discuss how the space agency was able to meet President Kennedy's challenge of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to Earth before the end of the 1960s. My guest today is William Berry, the chief historian at the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, or as most of us know it, NASA. Mr. Berry returns to our microphones at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington, D.C. Bill, welcome back.
Thanks, Rick. It's been my pleasure, as always.
Bill, it's been 50 years, a half century since the Apollo 11 moon landing. Why do you think it's still such an important event that is cherished by so many people?
Rick, I think the issue is that it's one of the great moments of human history where people have done great steps in exploration. It's like Columbus stepping on a new world, or any of the other great explorers from that century. It was the first time humans have set foot on another heavenly body, and I think a lot of people see this as the first step in human exploration of the cosmos in the centuries to come. 500 years from now, who will we remember? Probably not me, but Neil Armstrong, I suspect, will be well on every school kid's lips, just like Christopher Columbus was on mine when I was growing up.
It's incredible. Over the years, you've heard people say, well, they can land a man on the moon, but they can't do this. It's amazing that we're still using that moon landing as a touchstone to greatness. Have we come anywhere near that since?
I hate to think that human accomplishment is so limited that we don't have other great things. But it is a real touchstone because it was seen as such a huge task and such an impossible thing to do, to go from, when President Kennedy made that proposal, that we should go to the moon in a decade. We had 15 minutes of experience in space, and it was suborbital. Right, that was a huge step to make that challenge. And then we organized all the forces to make it happen. We had to build a huge infrastructure for NASA and industry. 400,000 people across the planet working in it. 20,000 U.S. companies involved in it. It was huge, and still we managed to pull it off on schedule despite expenses and costs and the human tragedy as well, with the Apollo 1 crew being lost on the way. But the fact that we pulled it off, I think it really stands out in people's minds. And that's one of the great legacies of Apollo, I think, is this belief that, in fact, humans, when well-organized and focused on a goal, we can do anything.
Speaking of going back and looking at the pathway to the moon, in retrospect, I understand the careful steps that NASA took in its plans to go to the moon. First of all, before Kennedy's speech even, were there plans to go to the moon?
Yeah, in fact, NASA's Apollo program actually began in 1960, before President Kennedy was elected. In the summer of 1960, NASA started plans for a lunar landing program called Project Apollo. The expectation was that we'd be landing on the moon in like the 80s, 20 or 30 years down the road, and that it would be a slow progression, that we would first learn how to operate in Earth orbit, maybe build a space station in Earth orbit, and then once got experience, we'd go out to the moon. So there are plans in development back as early as 1960, and people were thinking about it even before that. President Eisenhower hadn't approved that. The only part of the human spaceflight program approved by the government at that point as a formal project was Project Mercury. And the only real goal of that was to prove that, in fact, humans could, in fact, operate and live and work in space. It was a very modest objective. But clearly people at NASA and elsewhere were thinking that we could do more than that. And that early planning paid off when President Kennedy decided that it was time to do something bold in space.
Speaking of President Kennedy's speech to send a man to the moon and return him safely to the Earth by the end of the decade, did that take NASA by surprise?
It depends on which part of NASA you're talking about. Being here in Washington, you see this happen all the time. But people at the headquarters at NASA were consulting with the senior levels of the government, particularly Vice President Johnson, who was head of the Space Council at the time. And when President Kennedy wrote a memo to Johnson and said, we need to find something where we can beat the Russians. And so Johnson came to NASA and said, what is it that we can do? And so people at the senior levels at NASA took a look at the possibilities. They've been studying it since the previous year anyway. The consensus of opinion was that if we have to build a new rocket and the Soviets have to build a new rocket, then that'd be a fair fight and one that we thought we could win. So that's the proposal they made. Now, at the lower levels of NASA, most people working at NASA were busy doing their day-to-day jobs. They weren't aware of these conversations going on with the vice president. So when the announcement came on May 25th to Congress, a lot of people at NASA were taken quite aback by it. And it's interesting, if you look at the reports from people who worked at NASA, people at the working level at NASA, young engineers, they were excited. Go to the moon, 10 years, this is great. What a great challenge. The guys at the management levels at NASA, who were between the senior leaders who knew about it and the people who were working, they were like, holy mackerel, we have to make this happen? They were kind of surprised and I think a bit taken aback by it.
It's hard to believe that all this happened within just like 2 weeks after Alan Shepard did his first suborbital flight, the first American to go into space, was early May, and President Kennedy issued his challenge like May 25th.
Yeah, May 5th to May 25th, about 20 days.
20 days difference. And it's hard to believe, looking back at it, that the whole purpose of the NASA project from that point until landing a man on the moon was motivated by the Cold War.
Indeed. That's a thing that we don't often think about so much these days from a perspective of 50 years. But the whole reason why President Kennedy wanted something to beat the Russians with was because, the Soviet Union was making a case that it was a better system of government than Western capitalist democracy. And its proof was, look what we can do in space. Americans can't even do whatever this week's challenge was. The Soviets had a really large booster rocket, and they had a brilliant engineering team who was very small but very nimble. And so they were constantly looking for things where they could beat the United States on various things. So a lot of their program wasn't so much a program as a series of sort of propaganda tasks. But it didn't look that way to most everybody on the planet. It looked like the Soviet Union had been destroyed in World War II, and then 12 years later, they're the first country to launch a satellite. A few years later, the first person to put someone in space. It looked like they were way ahead. And Kennedy realized that this was a major political, geopolitical risk for the Western world. You had all these countries that had found their independence after World War II, and they were looking at this, and they weren't particularly keen with the Western model, given their experience with it in the past, a lot of them. And the Soviet system seemed pretty attractive, given its technical capabilities. So there was a lot of concern about where the trend would go. And in 1961, people actually believed that the Soviet system was better than the U.S. system. That was a real serious thing. I mean, nowadays, people kind of roll their eyes and go, oh, you got to be kidding me. You know, we know how the Cold War turned out. The Soviet Union falls apart. But at that point, that was a real issue. And one of the successes of Apollo was that we don't even think about that anymore. And in fact, I would argue that beating the Soviet Union to the moon undermined the legitimacy of the Soviet system very effectively, both internally in the Soviet Union and externally. And they became much less of a geopolitical threat during the 70s and 80s. And eventually the Soviet Union collapses, not because we beat them to the moon necessarily, but I think that was one of the things that nudged that system over the edge.
Going back again to the pathway to the moon, Mercury program was underway. Were any changes made to the Mercury program from after Alan Shepard and on after John Kennedy's speech to make way for making plans to go to the moon? Did they change the program at all?
Well, the pace of everything accelerated at NASA dramatically after the summer of 1961, and NASA itself grew. Mercury program was originally based at Langley Research Center, which is in Hampton, Virginia, and they realized that they were going to quickly outgrow the space available there, so that we started building what's now Johnson Space Center in Houston. So there was that move afoot. We started building the Kennedy Space Center with the launch of the Saturn V rockets. And so there are lots of things happened. NASA started growing dramatically in terms of personnel and size of the budget, and the program was accelerated, and a lot more pressure was put on NASA to perform. You know, the Mercury flights needed to go well. So the general effect of Kennedy's pronouncement in 1961 is that NASA gets put under a lot more pressure, but also finds that it has the resources to make these things happen and starts setting really lofty goals for itself.
You had mentioned that the plans for the Apollo missions came during the Eisenhower administration. So you had basically Mercury and Apollo program set. How did Gemini come about and why?
That's a great question, Rick, because in fact, there was no Gemini program originally.
Right.
There's Mercury, and NASA was simultaneously working on executing the Mercury program and sort of planning for this potential Apollo program in 1960. By 1962, the expectation had sort of been, well, you know, we'll build up to Apollo slowly. But it was clear that the acceleration of the program meant that NASA was going to have to learn to do lots of things with what they had quickly. And Apollo spacecraft weren't going to be ready soon enough, and Mercury spacecraft were not capable enough to do what you needed to do. They couldn't stay in orbit for very long. You couldn't do rendezvous and docking with the Mercury capsule. It was too rudimentary. Pretty clear to the engineers that they needed something else in between. So the first plan was, we'll make a Mercury Mark II, a bigger Mercury capsule, and that grew into the Gemini project. You know, Gemini for the Gemini twins, because it'd be a two-person capsule. And most people don't think much about it these days, but that program was absolutely critical to teach NASA and all the people around us how to fly in space for long periods of time, because Gemini could stay up for up to 2 weeks. Those poor guys who stayed up for 2 weeks in a Gemini capsule, it's a pretty small capsule for two people. But it also taught us how to rendezvous and dock, also taught us how to walk in space and build spacesuits that were capable of functioning on the lunar surface, which is the main purpose of spacewalking, and so many other things. It trained the ground control team that we needed. It built up our contractor workforce that allowed us to, you know how to manage and build big projects and do it quickly. So Gemini was absolutely critical to filling in the gap between Mercury and Apollo, but also teaching us how to get to the moon safely.
How was Apollo itself reshaped after the challenge?
Now, that's an interesting thing, too, that people don't often think about. The Apollo program was designed to be sort of a slow progression. We'd get to the moon in the 70s, maybe the early 80s. When President Kennedy says we're going to do it in a decade, that changes a lot of things.
Actually, 9 years.
Yeah, actually, less than a decade, right? By the end of the decade is halfway through 1961. So the slow progression plan, learning as we go along, is out the window. And now we have to build our systems quickly and effectively. And there's no time to spend a lot of time in Earth orbit, building a space station or things like that. Mm-hmm. So the long-term plans that have been talked about basically get thrown out the window, and it's a rush to get to the moon. Many people have argued since then that was maybe not the best long-term strategy, because when you get to the moon, then you're done. They made it easy for the Nixon administration to cut back the program and say, okay, well, we're just going to fly in low Earth orbit from now on.
Let's take a break now. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Today, we're marking the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. My guest is NASA Chief Historian William Berry. Here's a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, or from Apple Podcasts, which recently replaced iTunes. We hope you'll get in touch with us through either Facebook or Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or by sending us an old-fashioned email to pcusa@voanews.com. Now, back to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Again, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. My guest is Bill Berry, chief historian at NASA. Bill, we earlier talked about the role that NASA's Mercury, Gemini, and early Apollo manned space programs played getting humans to the moon. What about the robotic lunar missions like Surveyor and the Lunar Orbiter? How did they help with the moon landing?
Well, people often think sort of that human spaceflight and robotic spaceflight are sort of opposed things. You can do one or the other. And in fact, we've always done them together. You use robots and space probes of various sorts to go do the reconnoitering, the initial research, and make sure it's safe for humans to get there. So in the early 1960s, as the human program is speeding up, when we're finishing the Mercury program, starting the Gemini program, and developing Apollo, on the other parts of NASA, we're busily working on how do we get to the moon? What's it look like? Where's a safe place to land? Can we actually land on the surface of the moon? There was actually a scientist who believed that, and up until just before the launch of Apollo 11, who believed that once the lunar module landed on the surface of the moon, it was just pulverized dust, and the lunar module would sink into the surface of the moon and disappear. And so they were real concerned. So we built the Ranger spacecraft as a way to get close-up pictures of the moon. And it was a simple project. You put a TV camera on the front of a thing and run it into the moon and just transmit pictures back before it hits. And that was a program that proved to be, for all of its simplicity, very difficult to make happen. The first seven or so Ranger missions failed. And then we started having successes. At the same time, folks at Langley Research Center in Virginia were building the Lunar Orbiter program, which was designed to have a high-resolution camera in orbit to take pictures of potential landing sites so we knew what they looked like. And that helped narrow down the number of places where we were going to aim to land. And then, of course, the Surveyor program was designed to test that question of, can you land a craft on a surface and will it sit there properly? Can you do some research? And so the Surveyor craft was a soft lander and was designed to land on the moon. And we had great success with both Lunar Orbiter and Surveyor in terms of being able to prove out sort of the technologies for how do you land on the moon and proving that you can do research on the moon with a robotic craft and that it was safe for humans to go.
When and how was it decided that Apollo 11 would be the moon landing mission?
Now that's an interesting question. Often people will think, well, this clear progression. We go to the moon on Apollo 8, we test the lunar module in Earth orbit on Apollo 9. Apollo 10, we test the whole thing around the moon. And then Apollo 11 is obviously going to be the landing. That was not how people at NASA saw it in 1969. They had a series of missions. They were coded to be certain kinds of missions. And there was a mission planned to be the lunar landing mission. But all along the path, as they were training the crews and preparing for those, it was very flexible about which actual launch was going to fit into which category. And so when the spring of 1969 begins, after Apollo 8 successful going to the moon, they name the Apollo 11 crew, and NASA announces in January that Apollo 11 crew may be the first crew to attempt to land on the moon. So we knew that at that point. But if Apollo 9 had gone badly and the lunar module hadn't been tested properly in Earth orbit, or there had been a problem with the lunar module, they would have had to refly that mission again, which meant that that would have been Apollo 10. And so the first lunar landing would be 12 or maybe 13 or 14. So there wasn't hardwired that those things would happen. But we were incredibly good, number one, but also lucky that Apollo 9 went well and Apollo 10 went perfectly well. And so Apollo 11 was our first mission that we might attempt to land on the moon. Actually, turns out to be the mission we attempt to land on the moon. And then it's successful.
I'm curious about how the astronauts were chosen for the missions. I mean, you had, of course, missions that orbited the Earth, very famous Apollo 8, who circled the moon and sent back those wonderful photographs. How was it decided who would fly on the missions and who would be the first guy on the moon?
That's another great mystery. The person in charge of making the decisions about crew assignments for Apollo missions was Deke Slayton. Deke had been one of the original Mercury astronauts, but he'd had a medical issue and he was the only one not to fly until much later, actually, in the 70s. But Deke made those assignments, and how and why he made certain assignments is something that he generally didn't explain. He had a system where a crew would train as the backup crew for a mission, and then usually two missions later, because of the way the training cycle worked, they'd back up one crew, and then two missions later, they'd be the prime crew for that mission. But there were exceptions to that rule, and there were changes that get made because of various issues. Like Mike Collins, who flew on Apollo 11, was supposed to be the command module pilot on Apollo 8, but he'd had a problem with a herniated disc in his back, and he got that repaired, but that set him back, so he winds up getting pushed to the Apollo 11 crew. So there was a plan, there was a sequence, and so the crew that flies on Apollo 11 is, they backed up Apollo 8, largely. And so Neil Armstrong had been the backup commander for Apollo 8. His natural progression would be two missions later, he'd be the commander of the next mission.
Speaking of Michael Collins, what was his role? What did he do while Armstrong and Aldrin were walking around on the moon? What was his job? What was his role in the lunar landing itself?
Of course, his main job was to make sure that the command module was functioning effectively and that it was in the right place at the right time to pick up the crew. And if the launch off the surface of the moon had not been to the proper parameters, his job would have been to fly the command and service module down to grab those guys closer to the lunar surface. So there's a lot of contingency planning that happened for him. But he also had some research to do on the flight around the moon. He took a lot of pictures. The Apollo 11 crew overshot the landing site, and they didn't know quite where they were. So he spent a lot of time as he was passing around on this side of the moon, the Earth side of the moon, taking pictures of the general area to try and, you know, get a picture of where they were and trying to spot the crew with he had a little telescope. It was a navigation telescope, but he was able to look at the surface of the moon. He never did actually find the crew there, but he took lots of pictures of that. And there's some scientific objectives that he had in terms of photography of the far side of the moon and things. But generally speaking, I think if you asked him what his primary objective was, is to make sure that the command module Columbia was ready to go and was capable of bringing the crew back home.
Speaking of taking control of the lunar excursion module, a lot of people wondered why Neil Armstrong took over piloting the lunar excursion module, Eagle, I believe, and flew it to the surface of the moon.
There had been a series of computer alarms that a lot of people were confused about the computer alarms. Those alarms were actually not so much alarms as they were announcements that the computer was telling the crew, hey, I've overloaded, I've rebooted myself, and I'm good to go. 1201 and 1202 alarms, as they were known, were basically, I'm having a problem with overloads, but I'm still functioning just fine. And so the problem was that the crew hadn't seen those before. They had simulated just about every possible contingency for landing on the moon, but that was one that they hadn't simulated before. Fortunately, Mission Control had actually simulated that with a different crew a month or so before, and so the people in the back room, Jack Garman in particular, had a list of all the program alarms and what they meant. Mm-hmm. And so as soon as that came in, he was able to say, that one's okay, we're good. So they continued to land on the moon. The big problem when Neil got down to the surface was because they overshot the landing area, they were coming into an area almost outside where they expected to land, and it was more cratered than the other places. And there was a crater there, and there were a whole bunch of boulders about the size of small cars. And you don't want to land your lunar module on top of a boulder. So Neil very quickly assessed the situation and realized that there was a better landing spot. He basically stops and goes into a hover, and it hits the gas and goes sideways rapidly to get out of the way. Because, of course, the clock's running. The fuel is burning up quickly.
Right, 25 seconds of fuel left.
Yeah, the timing was actually to when he had to abort. There would have actually been probably more fuel on board than that. The clock they were counting was to when the mandatory abort time was. But nobody wants to abort that close to the surface of the moon either. So he was really kind of stuck because he either really needed to land right away or he should have aborted earlier. And Neil was a cool customer, and he'd been in tight situations before as a test pilot. So he steps on the gas, goes sideways, finds a good spot to land, and then touches down. And there are varying estimates of how much fuel was actually left on board Eagle when the descent stage when they landed. I've heard a number of different things. Gene Kranz tells people that there were between 17 and 40 seconds of fuel left behind. And I think that's about as good an estimate as we're going to ever get. But it was close.
Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, the Eagle has landed. It's on the moon. Neil Armstrong emerges a few hours later to make his first steps on the moon. And of course, his famous saying, that's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. Tell us a little bit about that. Why did he say that? And I understand there was like a little confusion as to what he really said.
Yeah, there's a missing A. Right? If you listen to the audio, which you just repeated.
Right?
And that's how it sounded on Earth, was one small step for man. Neil afterwards said that he meant to say one small step for a man, and they thought he said it. So NASA's position on that has always been that we always put the A in parentheses in that statement, saying, you know, because that was the intent. And he could well have said it, actually. If you listen to the audio from other parts of the EVA on the surface of the moon, there are a couple of other times when he says the, you know, letter A or the word A, and it gets clipped. So I think his microphones may not have been picking it up very well. So it may actually have been clipped out. And there have been some people who have done research on the audio and things and tried to analyze it. And I think they've largely been inconclusive on proving that he actually said the A. But that was clearly his intent. Now, why did he say that? A lot of people thought that was scripted, but I think very wisely, the NASA public affairs folks decided not to tell him what to say. It would have sounded forced, I suspect, anyway. You know, would have probably been flipping with his checklist, which would have been on his arm, trying to read it. So I think the smarter thing was that they let Neil say what he was moved to say. And I suspect there may have been some conversations with senior leadership or what might be appropriate. But Neil was a very smart guy, very well aware of the magnitude of what he was doing, you know, being the first human to step foot on the moon. And I don't think anybody was concerned that what he might say would be inappropriate. And as it turns out, what he said was great.
The job that Armstrong and Aldrin took care of was gathering a whole bunch of moon rocks and moon soil. How much did they gather?
It was about 50 pounds or so. We wound up, over the course of the program, bringing back about 842 pounds, about 380 kilograms of samples from the moon over the course of the six crews that landed on the moon. Apollo 11's objective was to get to the moon, prove we could get to the moon and land safely. So it was really an engineering test mission more than a science mission. But they did gather a substantial sample of rocks and soil. In fact, one of the most important samples they got was right at the end, just before Neil was closing up the boxes of rocks and sending them up to Buzz up in a lunar module to stow them for return to Earth. Neil realized that one of the boxes was pretty empty, and so he basically took the rock box and dragged it through the lunar regolith. Most of what they had was rocks. You know, they picked up individual rocks and put them into boxes. And there really wasn't a plan to grab. You know, there was a small sample that took the emergency contingency sample in case they had to leave in a hurry. So one of the first things Neil did was he scooped up some dirt and a rock. But most of the samples were individual rocks. And that sample where he dragged the rock box through the soil and gathered up a bunch of the sort of lunar soil, scientists will call it regolith because it's not really soil. But that proved to be a really important sample because individual rocks tell you about, you know, where those rocks came from, but the soil told us about what the surface of the moon was like and how it was formed, and lots of important scientific data came from that. And that was a sample taken kind of by accident because Neil felt like the boxes weren't full enough for all that work. So it was an important sample that they brought back.
Not only did they take stuff from the moon, but I understand they left certain things on the moon on purpose.
Well, of course, there are also scientific experiments that they brought to the moon, a seismometer and also a reflector to be able to measure the distance between Earth and the moon. It's still used today, actually, 50 years later. The solar wind experiment and also some commemorative items. Of course, they left a U.S. flag that they put up on the moon. They left a plaque on a lunar module that commemorated the landing. And they also brought along crew patches and commemorative items for the people who had died in the quest for the moon. So the Apollo 1 crew, but also Vladimir Komarov, who died in the Soyuz 1 accident in 1967, and Yuri Gagarin, who died the next year in an airplane accident in 1968. All those people were commemorated by the crew when they landed.
And finally, we had just heard that Chris Kraft passed away at age, what, 95?
95.
Can you share any thoughts about Chris Kraft and his role in the moon landing?
Chris Kraft is an incredibly important leader in the early space program and well into later in the program as well. But he was employed by the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, the NACA, which later becomes the basis for NASA. And he'd had a tremendous impact on aeronautics research. But then he winds up in the Space Task Group, and he's the guy who creates the idea of mission control. And he basically built that whole structure himself and trained the teams, was a flight controller himself, and then moved up into management positions. And he eventually winds up being the head of the Johnson Space Center. So he played a critical role in lots of places throughout the program into the 70s as a leader of the early NASA and making it possible for us to get to the moon. So incredible legacy of his contributions to the space program. He's going to be sorely missed.
Bill Berry, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about the wonderful legacy of Apollo 11.
Thanks, Rick. It's been my pleasure, as always.
That was William Berry, the chief historian at NASA. 4 days after humans walked on the moon for the first time, the crew of Apollo 11 returned to Earth. This was the sound of NASA's mission control once the moon travelers were safely back on Earth and aboard the recovery ship, the USS Hornet.
And the flags are waving and the cigars are being lit up. And clear across the big board in front is President John F. Kennedy's message to Congress of May 1961. I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to Earth. That has been accomplished.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today's program. Thanks for joining us for our commemoration of the Apollo 11 moon landing's 50th anniversary. The Science Edition of Press Conference USA was recorded and produced at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington, D.C. Our technician for today's program was Nick Ivanov. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to be sure to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice.
of America.